Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Implications of Recent Data Sets for the Current and Future Management of Breast Cancer. Today, we're going to talk about what happened at ASCO relevant to breast cancer. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Sarah Hurvitz from the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center in Seattle, Washington, and Dr. Sarah Tulaney from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. Today, we're here to talk about what happened at ASCO, and both of our faculty were quite involved in what happened at ASCO. As is always the case in our program, so we will be discussing the use of unapproved agents and regimens, so check out the prescribing information for each product for more. So we're going to actually ask each faculty to go through a bunch of papers that were presented at ASCO very, very briefly, just to sort of get it in our mind, and then we're going to try to spend as much time as possible chatting about clinical and research implications. Here are the papers we're about to go through. There's at least the same number of papers we could have gone through, a lot going on there, and breast cancer in general, and particularly at this ASCO meeting. I'm sure there's going to be a lot more coming up at the ESMO and then San Antonio. So we'll be talking about first a bunch of papers in hormone receptor positive disease, then HER2-positive, then Photoshop triple-negative, the usual three topics we always get into. But I just want to take a breath before we get started and also mention that I'm spending an additional hour with the faculty going through cases, and I interviewed them just because we needed more time to talk about this topic. So when we distribute this program, you'll be able to see that additional hour with the cases that the faculty have. But Sarah T., I just want to kind of take a step back and tell you about some. It's always dangerous when I think about stuff too much, but I was thinking about what we're talking about here today, and I just want to share an impression I have and curious what your thoughts are. I call this view from outer space because, you know, our primary target audience is the general medical oncologist, community-based practice. They're taking care of everything from myeloma, as you could see, CLL, bladder cancer, et cetera. And it's kind of interesting because I use this analogy of view from outer space because as we look down at the Earth, we see different countries that have quite a different styles. And I'll say what I'm talking about are the different tumor-based investigators and clinical research going. And as, in general medical oncology, as I was alluding to before, for example, you look at multiple myeloma, non-Hodgkin lymphoma there, it seems like all that we're talking about all the time is bispecifics and CAR T therapy. Lung cancer, we talk about immunotherapy, checkpoint inhibitors, as well as targeted therapy of people with activating mutations. We're going to talk about ADC and IO here today in breast cancer. Bladder cancer, first-line therapy for a while now, now press release. Neoadjuvant, IO, enfortumab vedotin, and pembro. Seems like that's going to be coming on board. AML, we used to think about, you know, 7+3, transplant. Now we have targeted therapy, FLT3, IDH, menin inhibitors, differentiation therapy. So, Sarah T., what I'm going to say is when I look at all these papers we're about to talk about what's hot, I see two themes in breast cancer. I want you to tell me whether you agree with what I'm seeing. So theme number one is optimization of endocrine therapy. We're going to be talking today about, you know, doing interventions with what I heard discussed at ASCO as molecular progression, ESR1. Kind of reminded me of the small CML country that we see out there where you treat people based on molecular findings, but also ADCs. And, of course, ADCs throughout oncology, not just solid tumors, but also hematologic cancers, really proving, you know, that looks like in general they work better than chemotherapy, maybe often better tolerated. So, Sarah, there's a lot of other stuff going on with breast cancer. We'll try to get into some of those things. But any thoughts about our view as, you know, coming from the general medical oncology setting about where new things are exploding now in breast cancer?
Yeah, no, I think you hit on some of the themes spot on, that definitely antibody drug conjugates are a big movement in breast cancer, really trying to replace standard chemotherapy with ADCs, not just in the metastatic setting, but also now we're trying to look at it in the early stage setting. And then I think your word of optimization of endocrine therapy is right. Not just are we trying to look at novel endocrine agents, but also how do we utilize them? And maybe we're trying to catch up to our hematology colleagues where they've known for a while that they can use things like MRD and ctDNA to help tailor therapy. And we're trying to figure out how to do that in breast cancer.
Sarah, any thoughts and any comments about, you know, areas outside of ADCs? We're not going to talk much about that, but outside of ADCs and endocrine therapy, Sarah T. mentioned MRD assays, which, again, you see all throughout oncology. Any thoughts about what the next big thing is going to be in breast cancer research, Sarah H.?
I think you've hit on the big topics. I think looking more at immune therapy outside of triple negative breast cancer is an area that continues to be active. We've seen some data coming through for new selective inhibitors. For example, KAT6 inhibitors are being looked at. A lot of ongoing trials there. We have new classes of PI3 kinase pathway inhibitors that have data. There was a press release regarding gedatolisib recently. So I think ESMO is going to be a really exciting meeting for a lot of these themes. But what Sarah touched on was optimization and personalization, which we've really been trying to go after with breast cancer. How do we personalize and select the right size therapy for our individual patients?
So I'm waiting to see whether you all get bispecifics in there. I was mentioning we did this program last week on biliary cancer. We talked about zanidatamab bispecific to HER2. Small cell lung cancer now has a CD3 bispecific. So we'll see if that ends up coming into breast cancer. I'm going to start out talking about one of the big issues here, a lot to talk about, which is endocrine therapy of breast cancer, both in the localized adjuvant as well as metastatic setting. The way we're going to do this today is the faculty go through a bunch of slides from ASCO, but what we really want to do is talk about what they mean. So Sarah H., let's start out with endocrine treatment.
Okay, so got a few slides to go through here. First, Natalie was updated. This is our adjuvant ribociclib study in patients who had node negative or node positive high risk ER positive disease. There was some updated data based on menopausal status and age. And to sum it up, ribociclib actually benefited patients regardless of whether they were menopausal or younger or older patients. There were fewer dose discontinuations due to adverse events in the premenopausal and younger women. And that's really the take home from that analysis. The TRADE study may be practice changing. Be interested in hearing what Sarah T. thinks of this, but doing a 1 month dose escalation of adjuvant abemaciclib starting at 50 mg BID for 2 weeks, followed by 100, did meet the primary endpoint where patients seemed to feel better and have better side effects, but actually had a lower rate of discontinuation. So they met their primary endpoint of about 30%. Who weren't able to stay on their target dose at the end of this study. The Right Choice study was, again, a study looking at very high-risk patients with ER-positive breast cancer, pre- and perimenopausal patients with what sounds like close to visceral crisis, looking at ribociclib in the frontline setting versus multi-agent chemotherapy. And we know that ribociclib won in this study. Well, they wanted to do an analysis and see how ribo measured up against chemo in patients with or without liver mets. And as you can see on the left Kaplan-Meier curve, those with liver mets did benefit from ribo. And on the bottom table, I think you can see the level of benefit was fairly similar, both for those with or without liver metastases. The INAVO 120 was updated, looking at inavolisib, palbo, and fulvestrant in a very strictly defined patient population that's PIK3CA-mutated endocrine-resistant disease that met strict glucose-based baseline requirements. We'd seen the benefits with this study in a previous report, and objective response rate and duration of response was better, but what was presented was the overall survival was significantly better in patients who received inavolisib with a hazard ratio of 0.67, underscoring that this really is level one evidence for the use of this in that strictly defined patient population. Now, there were AEs leading to discontinuation of treatment that were greater with inavolisib, And if you're looking at the side effects that we see, they're the usual suspects with the PI3 kinase pathway inhibitor, hyperglycemia, diarrhea, and rash that were greater with this agent. SERENA-6 is looking at whether or not we can use ctDNA monitoring in our patients on a first-line CDK4/6 inhibitor to select patients who appear to be progressing based on the emergence of an ESR1 mutation, and then proactively switch them to camizestrant or continue them on their current therapy. It's a complicated study design. I won't go through it all in the interest of time, but the PFS was better in the camizestrant patients. And then looking at their key endpoint, which was PFS2, it did seem to be longer with camizestrant versus an aromatase inhibitor. But this calls into a lot of questions here, actually. Because the way the PFS2 was measured or compared in the two arms, the patients who preemptively switched to camizestrant, really it was their first progression event that was being compared to the second progression event in those patients who continued on the AI. So it's not really, there's a lot of controversy about whether this was a fair comparison. It's also wondering whether or not PFS2 is a valid surrogate endpoint for overall survival. And the fact that patients didn't cross over doesn't allow us to know that switching early is actually benefiting patients in the long run by doing this strategy. So a lot to unpack from this clinical trial. This is the time to deterioration in global health status and quality of life, and it does appear that the CAMI-treated patients had a better quality of life parameter from this clinical trial. So the EMBER-3 study we know is imlunestrant versus fulvestrant or AI versus imlunestrant plus abemaciclib. Again, this is an oral SERD study, and we know that in patients with ESR1 mutations, imlunestrant is better than single-agent endocrine therapy. But then there was this interesting analysis of imlunestrant with abemaciclib versus imlunestrant in all patients, including those with ESR1 mutations or without, and using the abemaciclib and all these patients had had a CDK4/6 inhibitor before, was better than imlunestrant single agent. But the caveat to this is that the control arm was not fulvestrant. So we don't know whether in the ESR1 wild type patients, whether they need the imlunestrant combined with the abemaciclib in this study. Safety was updated. There really wasn't any big update from this study. As expected, abemaciclib was associated with abemaciclib side effects, and you see the diarrhea and neutropenia, cytopenias that come up by using abemaciclib, and you see more dose interruptions and reductions in the patients receiving abemaciclib. PROs were also measured and reported, and essentially PROs were consistent with patients receiving imlunestrant having preserved quality of life and benefiting from imlunestrant or as a single agent or in combination with abemaciclib.
So I want to bring up a few questions related to the data that Sarah H. just brought up, and I'm going to come back to you, Sarah T. Also to note that the first question that came in just as we were getting started from Swati in the chat room is ASCENT-04 now standard of care? We'll get there soon, but it actually reminds me that one of the reasons I say we're talking about ADCs is that first-line therapy of two of the three subset flipped into ADCs after this ASCO. I think this is going to be considered the ASCO Breast ADC. But let's get back to some of the things that Sarah H. was talking about. First, just to remind us what the current indications are for adjuvant CDK. We talked about the update of the NATALEE trial. And one question I had for you, Sarah T., is right now, for practical purposes, when you think about using a CDKI, first of all, do you stick with the FDA approvals in terms of which agent and whether or not to use it? And how do you choose between CDKs? Also, coming back to Sarah's discussion of the TRADE study that you all did, kind of reminds me of the control study in neratinib that was done escalating the dose. Is that, Sarah was saying that after she saw your data at ASCO, that's what she's going to do. Any comments about what you actually have seen with that trade strategy Sarah T., and how do you make clinical decisions right now in the adjuvant setting about CDK?
Yeah, no, all really good questions. So, you know, I will say I tend to be using abemaciclib in patients who would have met MONARCH E eligibility. So, you know, four or more positive nodes or 1 to 3 positive nodes with a high risk feature, simply because we have longer follow-up from MONARCH E, really supporting that there is continued benefit for abemaciclib even after discontinuation of the bema, suggesting maybe even a carryover effect. And since it is 2 years of therapy, whereas if people don't meet MONARCH E eligibility, but met NATALEE eligibility, so more of the intermediate risk population, then I'm using ribociclib in those patients. And that is using ribociclib for 3 years in that population. You know, there are issues where maybe someone's not a good candidate for one drug or the other. Someone has a prolonged QTC, you're going to give them abema, you're not going to give them ribo. Someone who has, you know, ulcerative colitis, inflammatory bowel disease, you're probably not going to give them abema, you'd probably give them ribo. So obviously I do individualized therapy too, based on, you know, comorbidities that patients may have.
So Sarah H., what about the node negative patient where you're thinking about a ribo, quote, high risk node negative? For practical purposes, how do you think that through? I mean, do you think people with any node negative theoretically is going to get some benefit? It's just a question of calculating what it might be and whether it's worth the risk or the cost. How do you make that decision about whether to use ribo in the node negative situation, Sarah H.?
Yeah, I base it on the NATALEE entry criteria and stick with that. Essentially, I think the tumor should be T2, just as it was there, and there has to be other high-risk features, either high-grade, high Ki-67, or, a high genomic score. For example, high-risk 21-gene recurrence score. And so I think that's fairly uncontroversial. What's a little more controversial is what Sarah T. just said, which is for those high-risk patients, those with nodal involvement, those with four or more nodes involved, you know, do you preferentially use abemaciclib over ribo? And I'm not convinced that we have the data to say abema is better for high-risk, because both studies had high-risk individuals. What we do know is that abema has been studied longer in those high-risk patients, so we have more mature data. But I think at each follow-up, we see fairly similar hazard ratios. So I'd be comfortable discussing both with patients and look at the side effect profile to help guide.
So here's a simple one for you, Sarah T. Serena 6. You know, it's interesting. You know, we were getting ready to send out a survey about this, and we sent it to one of our general medical oncology reviewers. And when we said, would you like to be able to do Serena 6? He said something that I don't hear from investigators, which is yes. But what we heard in the discussion from Dr. DeMichelle, Sarah T., was maybe not yet. We need more data. Any thoughts in terms of is this enough data to want to do it? Sarah H. said we need more data in this. We're PFS2. It does look pretty persuasive, makes a lot of sense. Sarah T., if you could, would you do it right now?
Good question. One, I just want to say, I think this was a really provocative and innovative trial, right? This is changing the way we think about when to change treatment in the metastatic setting. Normally we wait for, you know, imaging progression, but this is saying, hey, if you've got molecular resistance by developing an ESR1 mutation while you're on an AI, we don't really think AIs are going to work that well in that setting. So why don't we switch to an oral SERD and continue your CDK? And it did show, I think we all predicted it was going to show an improvement in PFS, as it did. But I think the question that we all have is, does this matter in the long run? If I switch you early, are you going to do better longer? I think one of the challenges with the trial design, though, is there, as Sarah alluded to, there was no crossover built into this trial. It was designed before oral SERDs were even approved. You know, elacestrant wasn't approved at this time. There was no data for camizestrant, you know, to know that it could have an approval in this time. So I understand why it wasn't built in, but it does make it hard to interpret to know if now versus later matters. What I think I take away from this is it using this switching strategy allows the patient to stay on endocrine-based therapy longer, And it does seem like they do have a better quality of life by not waiting for anatomic progression by switching earlier. And that could be very meaningful. I think what we want is a little more granular understanding of those QOL differences. Is it because maybe patients aren't starting to feel their disease progress because they switched to CAMI? That would be a big deal for patients. And so I think we'll see some of those data at ESMO with QOL data. And I think that would be good. And the PFS2, I think, is interesting. I think it's a little hard to interpret, again, given heterogeneous treatment in that setting, but I think clearly shows there's benefit. So I think it's an exciting strategy.
So Sarah H., I know that when we chatted before, your views are very similar to what Sarah T. just described. I'm curious if anything you want to add to that, but also, and it's been, again, a huge year for endocrine therapy. Of course, at San Antonio, we saw the EMBER-3 study now looking at imlunestrant with abemaciclib. It also just brings up the question in general of the post-Monarch strategy, Sarah H., of CDK after CDK. Of course, with Abema, we saw benefit. I'm curious, is that a strategy that you're using now? Does it matter what the first CDK is, whether it's Palbo or Ribo? What you think about Abema Imlunes? I'm sorry I give you so many questions. It's like a memory test so you can remember all these. But anyhow, and anything else you want to add about SERENA-6?
We're doing my mini mental status exam right, while I'm being interviewed. I think SERENA-6 is absolutely an innovative trial that is going to set the mark for the way we do studies going forward in breast cancer, and it's really interrogating how we use circulating tumor DNA. And I'm not ready to do it to use it to make treatment decisions in patients, because I think we may be preemptively changing therapy earlier without knowing that we're actually impacting survival long term. And we may not be changing how long patients are on endocrine therapy, because we do have a number of endocrine agents available. So, but super, super exciting area. And then that's all I remember of your question. So I failed my MMSC.
EMBER-3 and CDK yes. after CDK
yes.
and imlunestrant and Abema.
Yeah, so CDK after CDK, I think we have fairly good evidence now that if you start with palbociclib, switching to another CDK, meaning ribociclib or abemaciclib, is probably going to get you more mileage as long as the patients did well on the first CDK4/6 inhibitor and doesn't have super aggressive endocrine-resistant looking disease. And level one evidence, I would say, exists for abemaciclib based on post-Monarch. In terms of imlunestrant abemaciclib, I'm not convinced that we don't have it yet approved, and we don't yet have imlunestrant as a single agent approved. I'm not yet convinced in patients with wild type ESR1 tumors that we should be giving them imlunestrant abemaciclib. I think they may do just as well with fulvestrant abemaciclib. That question was not asked and answered in that study, but it certainly is provocative, and it'll be interesting to see what the FDA does with that when they're considering it.
So before Sarah H. continues, we'll talk a little bit about AKT and Capitella 291. Now I forgot what I was going to say. It's like, so, it'll come back to me. All right. Well, let's go back to Capitella there. And we saw some, if you want to go through some of the data there.
Sure. So Capitella 291 was looking at fulvestrant capivasertib versus placebo plus fulvestrant, and showed that it did improve progression-free survival in the overall population, but really in the patients with PIK3CA, AKT1, or P10 alterations. Keeping in mind, the majority of patients in this study had a prior CDK4/6 inhibitor, and under 20% had prior chemo. The survival from this study is not yet statistically significant. And the safety was reported. The most frequent grade 3-4 events in the CAPI arm that distinguish it from the standard arm was rash and diarrhea. And the rash can be substantial. And there were higher rates of AEs leading to discontinuation than the placebo fulvestrant arm, which is not unsurprising. At ASCO, we saw the VERITAC-2 phase 3 trial data, another oral ER degrader, PROTAC, vepdegestrant versus fulvestrant in patients who had prior CDK4/6 inhibitor, and just over 40% of patients had an ESR1 mutation, the majority of which had only received one prior line of therapy. This is the outcome in terms of PFS in the population of patients with an ESR1 mutation. There was about almost a three-month improvement with a significant hazard ratio of 0.57. However, if you look at all patients, including those with wild-type tumors, that benefit disappears. So we're seeing a theme with these oral ER degraders that really, if you're looking for benefit over fulvestrant, it really probably is going to be in those with an ESR1 mutation. Pretty good safety data. I was impressed with these data. Fatigue does seem to differ, but these other side effects seem pretty low overall, and I think this appears to be a pretty well-tolerated therapy. DESTINY-Breast06 presented an update in terms of biomarker results, so looking at T-DXd versus chemo in the frontline hormone receptor-positive HER2-low setting, or HER2-very low setting, and so looking at it by PI3 kinase AKT pathway activation, T-DXd still wins. Looking at it by baseline ESR1 mutation status, T-DXd still wins. And looking by BRCA1 mutation status, there's this interesting sort of divergence where patients with BRCA's mutations look like they're really benefiting from T-DXd, but I would caution you, the numbers are quite small. And the overlying theme is there's no biomarker that selects for patients who wouldn't do better with T-DXd compared to treatment of physician's choice. Now, there is this interesting analysis of looking at AI, not aromatase inhibitor, but artificial intelligence to determine or distinguish HER2-low and ultra-low versus null breast cancer. And so they wanted to look at the concordance among pathologists in determining HER2 status using just IHC or using IHC with AI assistance. It's kind of complicated, but the sum of the points is on the left in the upper corner, so on the y-axis is the true outcome, the true read, and on the x is the predicted label. And you can see that manual scoring sensitivity was low for cases with absent, meaning a HER2 IHC 0 or low, like one very low, ultra low, I would say. But when you overlay with artificial intelligence, you can raise the sensitivity and pick up more of these HER2 zero versus zero plus cases. So that's, you know, something that may be coming in the future to help our pathologists identify more patients who are eligible to receive T-DXd. And then finally, the TROPION-Breast01 study of datopotamab deruxtecan in hormone receptor-positive breast cancer. This was the trial that was published this year that led to the approval of TROP-DXd in HR-positive, the third ADC now available for hormone receptor-positive HER2-negative metastatic disease, showing about a two-month improvement in PFS, benefits across the various subgroups, and safety is shown here. And again, the safety we watch for with this agent is stomatitis, and you can also see things like cytopenias and interstitial lung disease, but stomatitis is the thing that we all really do talk about.
So actually, and I remember what I was going to ask Sarah T, and actually it was the same thing I asked. We did three CME programs at San Antonio. We had like 15 faculty. I think you two were both in one of those programs. I was asking all of you, like, what do you think about EMBER-3? And would you like to have imlunestrant available? Because I didn't know after seeing the data. And a lot of, pretty much everybody with Sarah T was saying we'd like to have imlunestrant available, even though it kind of looks a lot like elacestrant. Do you agree with that? And also, do you agree that the main mechanism of these agents is ER degradation? I noticed in the SERENA-6 presentation, the presenter, Dr. Turner, said that he looked at oral SERDs as not only ER degraders, but inhibitors directly of both mutant and non-mutant ER. So would you like to have lumestrant available as an alternative, Sarah T? And do you think these agents are really working by degrading the ER, or do you think some of it or a lot of it is competing for the receptor?
That's a good question. So one, yes, it's always nice to have choice of drugs available, and I think having imlunestrant would also be nice. But that being said, I think the question that Sarah brought up of imlunestrant abemaciclib, would we want to have that combination available? And I would say very much yes. And the reason is I don't know, and I totally agree with Sarah that I don't know that imlunestrant abema is better than fulvestrant abema in, you know, an all-comer population. Obviously, that wasn't an arm of comparison in EMBER-3. But I think it's at least as good as fulvestrant abema, if not better, and it's oral, and it would save our patients from getting these intramuscular injections. And so it would be huge for patients to be able to have, you know, a combination SERD and CDK. And we're really looking forward to seeing combination strategies move forward with these agents, because I don't think we really like to use monotherapy in truth, which is the challenge with our current approval of elacestrant monotherapy, and I think soon probably imlunestrant monotherapy. So that I think would be good. And then in terms of mechanism, you know, I think the idea is that you are not just degrading, but you're also inhibiting ER. You know, I think with vepdegestrant, I was hoping that we would see benefit that extended outside of just ESR1 mutation patients because of its mechanism of being a PROTAC, which is a little bit unique. And so I think we were all a little disappointed, because I think we were hoping to get an oral agent that would work in all comers. Now, obviously, the data looks great in the ESR1 mutation patients, but we keep hoping to have an oral agent that will also work in the wild type.
Of course, the other thing about EMBER-3, the combination, is you're using two strategies that you know have efficacy, abema after CDK and a SERD. And also brings up this sort of middle question everybody's asking, Sarah H., which is the PROTAC that was just presented, a phase 3 trial that you talked about with, I call it VEPTI for short. If that were available, imlunestrant is available, Sarah H., do they look indistinguishable? Anything seem to have a greater advantage or disadvantage from what you can tell right now and directly?
I don't see any real differences in terms of efficacy, as Sarah T. Eloquently stated at this point. We have to keep in mind that these studies have all been done in pretreated patients, because those are the patients who tend to have the acquisition of the ESR1 mutation. But it might be that they would appear to work better if we are using them in an earlier line setting. They may help delay resistance. So that's being looked at in a number of studies in combination strategies and as single agents in frontline setting and in early stage disease as well. I think the tolerability of vepdegestrant seems pretty good, though, from that standpoint. Again, not a head-to-head comparison, but I was impressed with the safety.
So we'll see where that lands. A couple other issues back to some of the things that Sarah H. just presented, Sarah T. One, you know, we found the our way of figuring out what people think the standard of care is. We asked 20 investigators like you all what they do. And one thing in terms of second-line therapy in a patient with PIK3 positive disease that we saw, like the second that CAPI was approved, it seemed like everybody slipped over to CAPI after certainly alpelisib. So is that generally the second-line therapy that you're using for these PIK3 mutant situations, Sarah T.? And what, now that we've had some experience with CAPI, which is being looked at in prostate cancer, incidentally, and I think there's going to be a positive trial. We did a program at the AUA Urology Association on AKT. It was like the urologists were like, whoa, what is this? But anyhow, of course, one key question here is we have all new toxicities, glucose issues, Sarah T. What's, now that you've had more time, of course, you started using CAPI when it was in one trial. What have you seen in terms of tolerability? Any sort of pearls about mitigating toxicity? And what do you do in the not rare situation where both ESR1 and PIK3 are mutated?
I know those are all excellent questions. So I will say I generally am thinking about using fulvestrant CAPI in the second line setting for someone who has a PI3 kinase mutation. you know, it is an interesting question. If someone is ESR1 mutant and a PI3K mutant, obviously then you have choice of considering right now elacestrant monotherapy or considering fulvestrant capi. There is data that has been presented looking at elacestrant in those patients who had both ESR1 and PI3K mutations, but it was a subset of the EMERALD trial where they looked at the people who had very prolonged benefit, more than 12 months on their AI-CDK before they went on to get elacestrant. And in those patients, the PFS looked like it was around 5 months, which is not dissimilar to what we've seen in the post-CDK setting from the Capitello trial for fulvestrant capi. But again, I would be cautious. These are all, you know, very exploratory analyses. And so generally speaking, I do consider inhibiting that PI3 kinase mutation a little bit more preferentially, particularly if someone has visceral metastases. I would prefer using fulvestrant capi in that setting. The side effects that you mentioned that we want to consider trying to prophylax against, you know, Sarah mentioned the issues that can occur, including some risk of hyperglycemia. It's not as bad, for example, as we've seen with alpelisib. So I don't usually prophylax patients with metformin, for example, when starting capivasertib. I do worry about some risk of rash. And so I do put them on a prophylactic antihistamine. There is a fairly high rate of diarrhea. Almost 70%+ of people do get diarrhea. So I do instruct them to use loperamide as needed with that particular agent. And so you do have to counsel them with that.
So we're going to move on in a second and talk about HER2 positive triple negative disease. One final really important issue though, Sarah H., there's only three, as you mentioned, only three ADCs that you're considering now in the ER-positive disease, and two TROP2 and, of course, TDXD. How do you think about sequencing? First of all, if you have all three available in the HER2-low situation, and then also in the HER2-0 situation, theoretically, what comes first, SASE, or what would you prefer, SASE or DATO? Any indirect thoughts in terms of indirect comparisons of efficacy of the two TROP2 ADCs? Looks like the tolerability issues are a little bit different. I'm curious about how you're thinking through decision-making in terms of really sequencing of ADCs after endocrine therapy and, you know, maybe capecitabine.
Yeah, so, you know, for patients in whom you want to use an ADC as the first chemo-based therapy, I think we only have data at this point with TDXD based on DESTINY-Breast06. And you know, I had this patient this week where we decided to leapfrog over oral capecitabine and go straight to an ADC because of the aggressiveness and disease burden with TDXD. We don't have that option at this point with SG or DATO. Sequencing after progression on frontline ADC is a totally different question. We don't have prospective randomized data to tell us how well that works, and I'm very reticent because these all have similar payloads. And I really do think that there's not a lot of mileage we get out of that second ADC. There's some data that maybe downregulation of the target is responsible for the development of resistance, a little bit of evidence about that. So maybe you can try it. But this is a very controversial area. And in those with HER2-0, and my choices are sacituzumab or Dato-DXD, it's really a discussion regarding side effect profile and frequency of dosing. And when I talk about side effect profile, it's not just ILD, it's also complete hair loss or not, and likelihood of neutropenic events, and GI side effects, et cetera. So I think these are important decisions to make in concert with our patients.
So one final point there in terms of Dato-DXD and mucositis, Sarah T., I was mentioning this program we just did with Erica Hamilton, and one of the things she was very, very strong in their discussion about was prophylactic steroid mouthwash to prevent mucositis. She says a lot of patients, they're doing well, and they stop taking it, and then they get into a problem. And, you know, now data is approved also in lung cancer, and they have no experience with mucositis. Any thoughts about tolerability of data and also how you choose between data and SASE, Sarah T.?
Yeah, no, I think stomatitis certainly is a potential concern with Dato. So we do tell all our patients to do Decadron swish and spit four times a day, which does tend to help prevent the mouth sores, I think, very well. And so I think definitely something to recommend. You do also have to recommend re-wetting drops to try to prevent the dry eyes with datopotamab deruxtecan. So important to counsel patients to really stick with that, because as you point out, you know, if you're doing well, you kind of like, ah, four times a day is a pain, and then they stop doing it so regularly, and then they can run into issues. So it is important to reinforce that. But then when choosing between the two drugs, you know, Sarah H. brought up some good points. There are different toxicity profiles with sacituzumab. Obviously, the scheduling is differently. There's day one, day eight dosing. Whereas with datopotamab deruxtecan, it's once every 3 weeks. So, you know, that could come into play for patients. With Dato DXD, you're not really getting a lot of cytopenias, whereas with sacituzumab, you will. And I am, you know, about half of my patients do require growth factor support with sacituzumab. So I think those are things that we do discuss as potential differences. And then obviously risk of ILD with Dato. So if someone had ILD to TDXD, I'm not going to give them Dato DXD. So I think it's a kind of an individualized approach in terms of which drug you use based on potential side effect issues that that patient may have. But I can't say I know which drug is better than the other. It's hard to tell. Their hazard ratios are fairly similar for hormone receptor positive disease.
So we're going to move on now, talk about HER2 positive triple negative disease. And of course, two of the most anticipated trials in a long time that Sarah T. both presented, starting with DESTINY-Breast09, now reporting T-DXd with pertuzumab in this interim analysis. I guess the combination hit the p-value required to do an interim analysis, and the T-DXd alone arm has not yet, but both of them will, I guess, be reported next year once they for their primary analyses. But right now, T-DXd and pertuzumab. So, Sarah, can you talk about this and some of the other studies?
Yeah, so here, this was really trying to understand if T-DXd should have a role in the first-line metastatic HER2-positive setting. And, you know, for over a decade, our standard of care has been a taxane with trastuzumab and pertuzumab, or our Cleopatra regimen. So this trial took first-line patients and randomized them to get T-DXd alone or T-DXd with pertuzumab or the THP regimen, where the trial was really designed to compare each of the T-DXd arms to THP, but it was not designed to compare the two T-DXd arms to each other. And just as you said, at the time of an interim analysis, the T-DXd plus pertuzumab arm met the very stringent criteria set for success, and so was reported at ASCO, whereas the T-DXd monotherapy arm did not meet those stringent criteria. So those patients remained blinded and continued to be followed on the trial. But what we saw was that the combination of T-DXd and pertuzumab did yield a significant improvement in progression-free survival, where the PFS was a little over 40 months compared to about almost 27 months with a THP arm. And you do see that the curves do separate very early, really, again, suggesting that there are some patients who are progressing on THP in that early line setting that are not progressing on T-DXd up front. And so I think overall, these data confirm that T-DXd and pertuzumab could become a new first-line standard of care in this setting, again, almost doubling progression-free survival. I think the challenge and the question that arises is that T-DXd in this trial was given until time of disease progression or until someone developed an intolerable toxicity and had to stop. Whereas when we give the taxane as part of THP, normally we will give taxane until someone has a good response or starts to develop a little bit of toxicity, and then we'll stop the taxane and leave them on trastuzumab, pertuzumab. And so people are often getting somewhere between 6 to 8 cycles. And so, you know, I think the issue is people are doing so well on T-DXd and pertuzumab. You know, we reported a median of a little over 40 months, but that may not be the median. It's at an interim time point. It could be much longer. And so I think the question is, how long do people stay on T-DXd? And so there are trials that are ongoing to try to address this. This is one such study, the Demeter trial, where patients get upfront T-DXd for 6 cycles and then go on to HP maintenance therapy. I think the other question is what do you do with that maintenance? We saw some beautiful data from one of my colleagues, Otto Metzger, from the Patina trial at San Antonio last year, where, in fact, if you added palbociclib to HP endocrine therapy, you got a PFS of almost 45 months in that upfront setting. And so clearly a really attractive, well-tolerated strategy for patients. I think the thing to remember, though, is this is specifically for hormone receptor positive patients who get through that induction phase, which, you know, is not necessarily the all-comer population. And so how we figure out how to tailor therapy in this upfront setting, I still think is a question that we have. But I think one toxicity that does arise with T-DXd is interstitial lung disease. And a question I think we all have in clinic is when someone develops grade 1 ILD, meaning that they have radiographic evidence of inflammation in their lungs or pneumonitis, but they're asymptomatic from that. What do you do in that situation? And certainly the guidelines tell us to wait until their ILD resolves, hold your T-DXd, and then consider rechallenging. And then the question has been is how do people do if they rechallenge after having grade 1 ILD? And so we saw this real-world presentation from Hope Rugo that was presented that showed that about 27% of patients who got re-exposure after developing grade 1 ILD had recurrent ILD, but most of it was low grade and I think, you know, generally okay. And even there were some of those patients who got rechallenged again and did okay after resolution. One take home that I took away, though, from this is there's often a question if someone has grade 1 ILD, should you give them steroids or not? And they did find that if you give steroids, it actually made that grade 1 ILD resolve a little bit quicker. So I usually do give 0.5 mg per kg of prednisone to patients who have grade 1 ILD, hold my T-DXd, wait for the ILD to resolve, and then rechallenge. And I often will do a dose reduction when rechallenging. I think another area that comes up that is of interest is what to do with HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer patients who have brain metastases. We know this is a common problem. Almost half of our patients over their lifetime, if they have HER2-positive metastatic disease, will develop brain metastases. Usually that rate increases by line of therapy, as you can see here. We've seen beautiful data from the HER2CLIMB study looking at use of tucatinib, where we saw, in fact, in patients with active brain mets that the combination of capecitabine, tucatinib, trastuzumab, in essence, doubles overall survival. So clearly impressive data in patients with brain mets. But I think our question had been, does T-DXd get into the CNS? It's a big ADC. How does it work in the brain? And so we had seen these data last year from DESTINY-Breast 12, looking at patients who do have brain metastases and found that the CNS response rate was very high. And so if you look at the patients who had untreated brain mets, their CNS response rate was about 80%. So clearly a very active drug. And the PFS in this setting was also very prolonged. And the OS that was seen was quite similar in patients, whether or not they had brain metastases or not. So clearly an active drug for patients with brain mets as well.
And we just tagged on the press release that came out fairly recently, looking at T-DXd followed by THB in the neoadjuvant setting, DESTINY-Breast 11. I'll be looking forward to seeing that. I don't know if that's on the menu for ESMO or hopefully soon. This whole conference is kind of reminding me of the tasting menu. I don't know if Vong's in New York City is still out there, that restaurant, but like every course is great. You want to eat more, but yet we keep going. So we will keep going here and sort of dive a little bit into some of the implications. And of course, Sarah H., the first thing we want to ask about is DB09. I'm curious how you're thinking through some of the questions that Sarah brought up, whether or not you think we're going to be moving in direction for a defined duration of T-DXd. And then in particular, what everybody wants to know is, like, how's a CDK inhibitor going to fit in potentially in the ER-positive patients? What kind of maintenance is going to go on? How are we going to make that decisions? Any prelude to what's going to happen over the next couple of years as clinicians sort through this, Sarah H.?
Yeah, I think that, as Sarah nicely presented, the data are really phenomenal supporting T-DXd with pertuzumab compared to our standard THP induction. The PFS improvement is substantial. I don't think it's a big stretch of the imagination to imagine a survival benefit compared to THP. The big question is whether the P is contributing and whether we really need pertuzumab. But the bigger question is what's out there, which is, can we use this as an induction strategy and maintain patients, transition them to HP with or without a CDK4/6 inhibitor and endocrine therapy if they're HR positive? My hope is that we'll be able to do that and that we'll have evidence emerge in upcoming studies that are maybe being planned now to address in a randomized fashion whether or not we can do that. I think we are still limited in our ability to pick out those patients who are likely to experience early disease progression versus the long-term responders. And so a lot of work is really needed there. But it is practice-changing, not yet FDA-approved, but I think pretty soon we'll be able to utilize T-DXd pertuzumab in our patients in the frontline setting. For those patients who are currently on maintenance HP, that's where I am discussing using a CDK4/6 inhibitor, palbociclib, and endocrine therapy if it's hormone receptor positive, especially if they've recently come off of their induction chemo. If they're like in year 4 of HP maintenance, I'm usually not going to do anything different with that at that point.
Yeah, when we do all our surveys, it seemed like the second patina was presented. People wanted to do it and were trying to do it immediately. Another question back to this issue, rechallenge, Sarah H. I noticed there were 19 patients with grade 2, symptomatic, mildly symptomatic ILD who got rechallenged. And actually, I think only 3 of them developed it when rechallenged. Have you used it in grade 2 ILD, Sarah H., and any situation you can envision a patient's having a great response? Maybe they're generally good condition where you would rechallenge after grade 2?
I don't. Not outside the context of a trial. I am not brave enough to do so just because we do see deaths with this agent. And so I'm quite reticent to do so. I suppose if this is a patient who had been through multiple lines of therapy and finally was responding to this and had complete resolution of grade 2, we would have a balanced discussion. I've not entered that situation. And because we're using T-DXd earlier now and we have other therapies available to patients after, I wouldn't advise rechallenging after symptomatic ILD, but I have rechallenged after asymptomatic.
So final question, actually one from the chat room. Sarah T. Jitender wants to know, what about T-DXd with leptomeningeal disease? And also I want to know, I think I know the answer again from surveying investigators like you right now, what your second line therapy is, HER2-positive disease. And not too long ago it was tucatinib with the HER-CLIMB regimen. I'm seeing a lot more T-DXd. Any thoughts? Leptomeningeal disease and second line with brain mets, Sarah T.
Yeah, I think we saw from DESTINY-Breast12 that at least with parenchymal brain mets, obviously T-DXd is getting into the brain and having great activity. There is some data for T-DXd in patients with leptomeningeal disease. There was some data from the Rosette trial as well as case series, including work from Dana-Farber that had shown really nice prolonged disease control in the brain in patients with leptomeningeal disease. So I definitely do think about T-DXd in our LMD patients. So definitely a good choice there.
All right, so we're going to move on now and finish out with triple negative disease, starting out with an update on Olympia. Sarah?
So with Olympia, this is a trial that obviously had looked at using a PARP inhibitor in patients who had high-risk BRCA-mutated disease in the adjuvant setting, both including triple-negative as well as ER-positive disease. And at ASCO this year, we saw data with prolonged follow-up from the Olympia trial. And here you're seeing the IDFS by hormone receptor status showing continued benefit now with longer-term follow-up that continues to improve a hazard ratio around 0.6 in in both of these cases with about 6 years of follow-up. So again, benefit irrespective of receptor status, and the survival benefit, again, has been seen before and again persists now with hazard ratio of 0.72. I think what was interesting was this, with this longer-term follow-up, is that they did not see an increased risk of MDS or AML, which I think is really important now with the longer follow-up. And they actually did also see a reduction in rate of secondary malignancies, suggesting that maybe the PARP is also helping prevent new cancers from developing in these patients with BRCA mutation. So I thought that was really nice to see. We also saw some data from this ABCSG45 trial, which was kind of an intriguing study, really trying to see if there's a role for PARP inhibition in the early stage preoperative setting that would extend beyond patients with BRCA mutations. So this looked at combining PARP with platinum therapy and comparing it to anthracycline taxane-based therapy in patients who had triple negative disease that could either have a BRCA mutation or have homologous recombination deficiency using a myriad assay. And what they found was that overall, the TAC chemotherapy did do better than carboplatin. However, when you look specifically at the patients with BRCA mutations, there you did see that there is a trend towards better RCB response with the platinum PARP treatment. But when you look at those patients who do not have a BRCA mutation, that's clearly where the chemotherapy, the TAC regimen, is doing much better than the PARP-based treatment. And to me, this kind of shows that we're not quite ready to be using PARP inhibition outside of patients with germline BRCA mutations. We haven't really defined this HRD population well enough to understand the role for PARP in that setting. We also saw some really exciting data about ADCs in the triple negative setting. We saw specifically data focused on sacituzumab govitecan, where we saw data from ASCENT-04 looking at the combination of sacituzumab and pembrolizumab compared to chemotherapy and pembrolizumab in the first line triple negative setting for patients who have PD-L1 positive disease. And there we saw that sacituzumab pembrolizumab did do better than chemo pembro with an absolute difference of about 3.4 months between the two arms and a hazard ratio of 0.65. So nice to see that improvement. And certainly this data is also still immature for overall survival. There was a slight trend towards overall survival. One thing I would note is this trial did provide and offer crossover treatment to the control arm patients, and about 80% of patients in the control arm did go on to receive sacituzumab if they got a subsequent line of therapy. So it will be interesting to see the longer-term follow-up from that trial with regards to survival with such a high crossover rate. We will see data from ASCENT-03. I think of it as a sister study because this is a first-line trial for the PD-L1 negative population of sacituzumab versus chemo. We've seen a press release that suggests that the sacituzumab did do better than chemo, and these data are planned to be presented at ESMO, so could lead to a potential approval of sacituzumab in the PD-L1 negative IO ineligible population. We may see data from Dato-DXd and the TROPAN-Breast02 trial, where they compared Dato to chemotherapy, a physician's choice, also in that PD-L1 negative IO ineligible population. So will be interesting if that becomes available. The sister study to that of combining datopotamab deruxtecan with checkpoint inhibition is still enrolling. So that data probably won't be available for a little while. So I think we're going to see a change in our first line approach for triple negative disease with ADCs moving into that frontline setting for both the PD-L1 positive and negative patients, which I think is great for our patients. But there are other ADCs. This is sacituzumab tirumotecan, or I like to say sac-TMT for short. This is also a TROP2 ADC with a TOPO1 payload. This agent has been studied in the triple negative setting and in fact is approved in China, where they did a trial that was very similar to the ASCENT trial comparing sac-TMT to chemo in pretreated metastatic triple negative disease, where sac-TMT did do better than chemo. And then we saw these data at ASCO looking at sac-TMT in a single arm setting in the first line triple negative setting, irrespective of PD-L1 status, where we saw really very impressive data where you see see here the objective response rate of around 70% with very prolonged duration of response of over a year. So I think very promising to suggest that sac-TMT could also have a role in the first line setting. And in fact, there is an ongoing trial looking at sac-TMT in the PD-L1 negative population. There are other trials that are investing ADCs in the early stage setting. There's a HERTHENA trial looking at HER3-DXd preoperatively, and there's also a pre-op study of sac-TMT and a pre-op study of Dato-DXd. So obviously there's interest in moving these TROP2 ADCs into the pre-op triple negative setting as well.
So a couple of follow-up questions. Sarah H., coming back to PARP inhibitors and the use of adjuvant olaparib, I'm curious how you decide who's going to receive olaparib and post-neoadjuvantly and adjuvantly. How do you approach that?
Yeah, it's essentially following the Olympia entry criteria. So the majority of patients tend to be triple negative carrying a BRCA mutation, and the entry criteria are a little bit more generous there. And of course, we have the survival data supporting it. So that's really a no-brainer. Where it gets a little dicey is when you have a patient with a hormone receptor positive breast cancer that's really high risk by virtue of a lot of disease burden at the time of surgery or heavy residual high-risk disease, and then you're toying with, okay, do I use abemaciclib, ribociclib, or olaparib first? And I usually will choose olaparib first when they have a BRCA mutation because of the survival benefit, and then after olaparib is done, we'll discuss use of a CDK4/6 inhibitor if they're up for additional therapy. At that point, sometimes they're not.
So, yeah, that ABC trial looked very interesting, too. Carbo and olaparib, very high past CR in patients with HRD mutations, really interesting. I remember there was a telazoparib neoadjuvant trial by itself that I was like, when are we going to do more of that? I think it was a few years ago. So final issue, back to you, Sarah T., the use of sacituzumab and IO pembrolizumab first-line metastatic setting. I think the big question a lot of people have is, what about the common situation where the patient's also gotten an IO, usually pembro, in the neoadjuvant and post-neoadjuvant setting? Are you going to still use an IO on relapse? And if you're not, are you going to use sacituzumab without an IO?
I don't know. It's a good question. I think one, you know, unfortunately, that we don't really have data for to answer. In ASCENT-04, just given the timing of when that trial was conducted, you know, it's a little under 5% of patients that actually had seen a checkpoint inhibitor before going on to that trial. So we just didn't have a lot of patients who had gotten a checkpoint in the early stage setting. So we don't really know how to address that question. I would say, you know, we kind of make rules up. I think most of us tend to say, well, if you haven't seen that drug in a year, we'll probably give it to you again if you're PD-L1 positive. And so I think most of us will probably re-expose people to checkpoint. But truthfully, we'd need a randomized trial of like sacituzumab plus minus pembro in someone who's previously seen a checkpoint, which we don't have to really address that. But I think that's what I would do now, is just base it on disease-free interval and if they tolerated that checkpoint inhibitor before.
So Sarah H. and Sarah T., thank you so much. Audience, thank you for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Sarah. Have a great day.